Right now, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk, who is on the road, and I do mean on the road this morning. David, of course, comes with us with the Media Beat. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has a terrific website called themediabeat.us, and we are pleased to have him join us on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. I'm glad to be talking again with the always observant Marshall Miles from Europe for a few weeks, not from our usual base of the media capital of the world, New York City. Specifically, I'm reporting in again from Dublin, Ireland. The Irish media are, of course, concentrating greatly on the Ukraine war, as most of Europe is. And of course, in the United States, you're getting a fair amount of reporting, too. From Moscow this week, there came that intriguingly presented meeting of the Russian defense minister with President Putin, well orchestrated for the cameras of live state television, or perhaps awkwardly staged might be a better description for it. It showed as Putin himself, live on national television, taking the decision to no longer attack the metalworks plant at Mariupol in southern Ukraine, where some 2,000 Ukrainian military defenders have been holed up for 5 weeks now, along with many sheltering civilians, men, women, and children, in basement shelters. In announcing this decision, actually giving the, or appearing to give the order on TV, as it were, Putin seemed to many anxious to get credit for avoiding more Russian casualties. And that, to many analysts, is suggesting that he's perhaps uncharacteristically worried about Russian public opinion rising against the human cost of this war, the cost to Russian itself, that is.
You know, the horses
so
are...
Once again, you remember, Marshall, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the technology for surveillance in this war. And again, that technology, eyes in the sky, satellite photography, has been offering evidence, this time on the outskirts of Mariupol, of more mass graves being dug. Four huge trenches, it seems, each of them an estimated 90 feet long. And disturbing evidence is also reported, coming from the town's deputy mayor, saying that Russian forces have been using mobile crematoria, moving around in what's left of the town. All of this suggesting that by burying or by fire, the Russians are now trying to conceal, or have been all along perhaps, that they're now making extra efforts to conceal traces of their war crimes.
And, you know, when you look at what Russia's doing, it's a classic case of, I look at a lot of different news programs. And the great thing about streaming services, David, is that I now am a member. I have news services that come out of Germany, out of France, out of Europe, you know, many different streaming news sources that I can get a balanced look at the coverage in whole, not just American coverage. And what I see is that, yes, the Russians are doing their scorched earth policy unbelievably well by absolutely wiping cities basically off the face of the earth. But when you look at the amount of land that they have gained since they decided to focus on the eastern and southern end, the only place they have, which is a lock, is where Mariupol is. Other than that, the Ukrainian army has made small advances to the north and to the northeast in recapturing territory. So once again, what Russia does with its long-range missiles is make it look like they're just destroying the enemy, but they are. It is going to come home to roost. Already, a father went public in Russia about the deaths. It is going to come home to roost. I mean, estimated now between 10 and 20,000 Russian troops have been either killed or seriously injured, and you can't hide that for much longer.
Yeah, and we'll be seeing possibly those figures changing, and disastrously so for both sides, of course, but it will be interesting to see how badly it's taken on the Russian side when they do start their long-expected and long-predicted push in from the east, north of Mariupol, into that region of Ukraine, which has always been in some degree contested because of the large majority of Russian speakers there. But it's good that you're noting all the different dimensions that you can get on this story by consulting or at least checking in with with varying sources, varying national sources across Europe, especially, as we've been doing in this slot many times. It's very good to get other perspectives on big, major international, so on any story, really. But when it's big and international like this, it's really helpful to take in more than your usual streamers of news. And certainly, I would say it's best to, you know, work. As a consumer of news, work outside the confines of our own national broadcasters in the United States. Good though those network divisions often are, and the news channels themselves, even though the news channels suffer from that constant problem of having to fill 24 hours and always doing, you know, needless repeats that can get easily mistaken for current news when, in fact, it's somewhat old. But I'd like to move on to the other big European story this week, reported Europe-wide. This weekend's second and final round of the presidential elections in France. Voting day is Sunday, of course.
Yeah, that's why.
And it's
a tense contest.
Tense contest. Sorry, I'm talking over you. Go ahead.
No, but that's why I added more news sources, because Le Pen, her reemergence as a candidate and a potentially strong candidate, happening at the time when Russia is invading the Ukraine and Russia would really like to break apart the European Union. My first question to you in that was going to be, is this war against Ukraine going to hurt her in her bid? Because we look at her, at least I look at her, as a much more aggressive and much more intelligent Donald Trump.
Interesting comparison. Yeah, well, the positions in France are extraordinarily clear, I suppose, is one way of putting it. Polarized is another way, I suppose. We have the incumbent president, Emmanuel Macron, who I think it's fair to describe as occupying the center-right of the political spectrum, though he did previously serve with an economic brief in a socialist administration. And he's facing this threat, as you say, from the extreme far right in the person of Marine Le Pen, the leader, as was her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, of an ugly movement whose image she's tried to soften. I mean, it's not an easy thing to soften, but she's tried. Under her father, it was known as the National Front. And she's recently named it the National Rally, probably because that word front, especially in the context of National Front, has long been strongly associated in France and many other parts of Europe, including Britain, where we had the same phenomenon with out-and-out Nazism. There's no other word for it. Her right, far-right policies have a populist dimension to them, too, and it's a matter of concern throughout Europe that she made it to this final round. And it's twice running now, because she also did it back in 2017 when Macron beat her very soundly, essentially two-thirds to a third of the voting population. I mean, this time it's disturbingly a much closer race. And the Ukraine war does feature in it. There was a lengthy one-on-one TV debate this week. France has been holding these TV debates in elections, presidential elections, ever since the 1970s, almost as long as the United States has, with Kennedy and Nixon starting the tradition in 1960. And the French have predated other European countries with this central feature to an election, too. Here in Ireland, they started having contenders debates in 1982. And Britain, fusty old Britain next door, we might say, didn't start having such debates till 2010. With Macron versus Le Pen, France's commentariat, if I can call it that, tends to be very centrist in outlook overall, judged the debate winner to be Macron, who went much more onto the offense than he's wont to do in discussions of any kind. He accused Le Pen of being bankrolled by Russia. And she has indeed been very friendly towards Putin, not unlike the American public figure you mentioned, who shares many of her attitudes and views. Interestingly enough, her supporters complained after the debate that Macron had been bullying her, somewhat different from the Trump experience. One fairly right-wing commentator among several, not as far right as Le Pen herself, said that if you allow yourself to be bullied on national television, then you don't deserve to be president of the country.
You know, we look but at...
Go on.
No, you go on.
Since that debate, though, which was two days ago now, Macron's lead in the polls, as conducted by the French media, has surged quite a bit to 56%, as against Le Pen at 44%. A substantial gap, but it's far from a done deal for Macron. Even this currently improved estimate means that his lead over Le Pen has actually slumped by a third since last time in 2017. We'll know the actual election result late on Sunday, French time. There'll be a what's usually a very reliable exit poll published that evening, Sunday, and official institutional confirmation of the result is expected on Monday. Everyone's a little bit on edge. I don't think Macron's victory is absolutely guaranteed at all.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, during this phase of the campaign, has Le Pen basically, I thought I read and heard that she would not be as involved in the defense of Ukraine as France is now. Has that become a major aspect in this political war?
Well, everything is a point of contention. She has made it, it's not absolutely clear, but the suggestion is that, yeah, she wouldn't be as vigorous in support of Ukraine as Macron is. Macron occupied, he tried to, early on in the campaign, present himself as a problem solver for this entire war, you know, as we'll recall, got quite engaged in peacemaking efforts between Putin and Ukraine. President Zelensky took calls for him, so did Putin. But it became less and less of a valuable thing for him to do, either in terms of finding peace in the war or helping him in his domestic efforts to dominate the election campaign. He's still ahead, but not securely so. And I think the Ukraine war is having its impact and making people think who are supporting Le Pen perhaps think again because of her closeness to Russia. Other matters are counting against her too. I think one issue that she's stuck to pretty strongly. And not felt the need to soft pedal it in this election, coming back to bite her all the same, is her determination to outlaw the hijab being worn openly in France's streets and public places. That is striking many French, even on the right and even further along the political spectrum towards the far right. They're thinking that kind of impractical and certainly doesn't fit with the French principles of fraternity, equality, and liberty.
We're speaking with David Tereshchuk, of course. Once again, this is the Media Beat. Let's come back to this country, and there's nothing worse as an individual person or as a politician that coming out and saying something very strongly and saying, I did not say that, and then the next afternoon, about 6 hours later, a tape was produced that said, you did say that, and I'm talking about in the U.S. Political battles. The leader of the Republicans, McCarthy, he denied that he considered asking Trump to resign. And then, of course, a videotape came out exactly stating the opposite. And Liz Cheney, his conversation with Liz Cheney was made public. I mean, somehow you just look at this, and it's bad for McCarthy in two ways. It's bad for McCarthy with a standard of people that want to believe him, but it also now puts him on the rails with Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. And the vital element in all of this is the ability that almost every citizen in the country, in many parts of the world, has available in their own pocket the capacity to record whatever's going on. And, of course, that means that people can be held to account for what they actually say, even sometimes when it's in private. I mean, we've long had the tradition of what in the trade is called the hot mic recording, which is when someone's talking unaware that they're being recorded. Often it used to be that it would happen in a TV studio or a radio studio, and people would think that they were not on air, but they were, or at least they were being recorded. And the truth of what they say in their own very recognizable vocal tones is there on the record to say, even if you deny it, it remains well known to the public, or it can become well known to the public after you've tried to deny it, which is perhaps even more embarrassing. We have a similar thing just across the water in Great Britain at the moment. The Prime Minister denied that he ever went to a party at his workplace, number 10 Downing Street, during the time when the COVID clampdown meant that no parties were supposed to happen anywhere. And so this lawmaker was revealed to be a lawbreaker recently. But even at the time, he was saying that he did not know that this was a party that he was going to. It was a work event. That was his phrase. And even now, he's gone before in the last couple of days, twice over, one day after the other, saying in Parliament that essentially his defense is the same as he said then. And in the meantime, he's been fined by the police for that breaking of the law. So, he can say again and again something that is patently not true, but somehow or other, the public seems to, in Britain's case, the British Conservatives anyway, are accepting it and saying this man can lie. That was the word that was used in Parliament yesterday. He can lie his way out of it. Parliament in Great Britain has a long-standing tradition as you cannot call anybody else who's a member of Parliament a liar. It's one of those totally verboten words. But in this case, it was spoken quite freely and quite out loud by a Scottish National Party member, a leader, in fact, in the House of Commons yesterday, called the Prime Minister a liar. That is unheard of in British parliamentary history, but it was said. And, the evidence is clear and proven by police investigation as well as internal investigations. And the next investigation that will happen will be one conducted after a vote yesterday in Parliament by a parliamentary investigatory committee itself. So we'll have this particular leader held to account for things that he claims he never did, which he did do, and on a parallel, I guess, with all the many cases in America and elsewhere where politicians are held to account for what they've said, even when they deny that they ever said it.
It's an amazing world in which we live, and I have to ask your opinion in our final 8 or 9 minutes. The Democrats are in a very, very, very poor position for the midterms. There's no doubt about that. But there's a huge dark cloud that is brewing over the Republican Party, and that is the potential war between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump for the run of the presidency in the next presidential election. Anybody that looks at what DeSantis has done in Florida is he's trying to build a base that Donald Trump supporters can come and support. I just see the Republicans possibly, maybe not for the midterms, but for the next presidential race, really putting themselves at a bad place. Now, Joe Biden has said he's going to run again when his term is up. But what do you think about this Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump split in the party?
I can't think of anything more ugly in terms of a political contest. I think for what one could say, one could describe still, if they still exist anymore, I'm not sure about this, but old world, it has to be, I suppose. That's the kindest description for them, perhaps. But old world Republicans, where do they go in a contest like this? That's a problem that's facing the Republican movement now. If the fight is between the politics of DeSantis from Florida and Trump from Florida, I think that is such a an awkward and unprepossessing choice for Republicans to make. It's whatever comes out of it is going to be a mood of political combat that's bound to pollute the entire political air, I believe, for the next 2.5 years. The midterms will be a prelude to it, and already it's turning pretty ugly in places. We know that. And if the Democratic candidate will indeed be the incumbent president, he's going to benefit enormously from it. But in fact, almost whoever runs, if Biden, on reflection, and particularly on reflection about his age most of all, if he decides not to run in the end, which is still an open possibility, whoever the candidate is, will, I think, have a distinct advantage because of the crumbling of any kind of solidarity amongst the Republicans that's evidenced by the DeSantis-Trump divide.
Well, I'm a little surprised that in a meeting with President Obama that President Biden mentioned that he wanted to, at this time, run, because when he got the nomination, one of his famous quotes is, I realize I'm a placeholder to the next step for the Democratic Party. I mean, he made that clear.
Absolutely.
And so he should probably just lie low on that, because it's going to upset a lot of people if that's not the case. I mean, I think he is the perfect bridge for the Democratic Party to go from what it was to what it eventually wants to be, whatever that is. But I don't think he would be the perfect bridge if he ran for president again in another 2.5 years. I think it would be a big mistake right now to get into that mode.
Yeah, and I think most of the country would regard it as a graceful retreat if he were to decline to run again. You don't have to be a Johnson and defeated in the public opinion polls to gracefully decline the nomination a second time, which we'll see. Can I bring up a more international matter, though?
Yes, absolutely.
On the broader global canvas, China is looming again.
Yeah.
In the person of Chairman Xi Jinping, because he caught the international media's attention this week with a lengthy statement to the world, and as often a verbally convoluted one, which you have to parse very carefully. He was calling for an end to the entire present international order, with, of course, the United States as the major power. But what he foresees instead, he used a phrase that translates into English as the new global security initiative. Well, Xi didn't mention Russia's current aggression by name, but he did appear to be favoring it, using the same terms as Putin uses when he condemns international alliances' interference or big power interference in individual nations' so-called, and I quote him here, legitimate security concerns. And we know what Mr. Putin regards as legitimate security concerns. It's the right to invade a neighboring country. And as a specific example of what Xi means in his new order, it was revealed this week that he concluded a new deal in the Pacific Ocean, a deal with the Solomon Islands. And in this deal, China is now going to be enabled to dock its warships in that small island nation. The islanders will get in return, well, it's not very clear what they'll get officially. Most likely a whole lot of Chinese moolah, if I can call it that. No, I jest, of course. China's currency is actually the yuan, isn't it, and renminbi. But thinking globally, it strikes me that there's something of a parallel here with the Central African country of Equatorial Guinea, which China's been in talks with as well, about becoming the location for China's first military base in the Atlantic Ocean. The Chinese already have a base for the last 5 years, in fact, on the eastern side of Africa, at a port in the impoverished country of Djibouti, looking out onto both the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and thence toward the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. And as such, Djibouti is obviously a specially strategic location. And America's own central command has also been there for the last 20 years. So it's a potential point of great conflict. But back in the Pacific, there's been what the Japanese media are calling a scramble to respond to this new deal of China's. The Biden White House has suddenly dispatched Kurt Campbell. He's the chief Indo-Pacific advisor, off to the Solomon Islands to express America's concern. The first task could be, I suggest, to reopen the U.S. embassy there. Our previous embassy has been closed since 1993, one of those end of the Cold War moves to cut back on diplomatic outposts that were apparently no longer needed. An observer's best response to that might be, But I can't say for sure myself. But here's a very specific piece of international relations taking a whole new turn that needs to be closely monitored. And we'll have to see how the Biden administration does cope with this one.
You know, I think what you're bringing up here about what we've done, how we've contracted and moved inward and not had as many embassies. I think people tend to lose sight of how important these embassies are. Yes, yeah. I mean, there's nefarious things that go on with embassies in big countries. But you're exactly right. Embassies in countries keep the information line flowing, so something doesn't get to a point where something urgent has to be done.
Sure, it's certainly embarrassing to be caught on the back foot, as it were, with this deal by China. With you know, admittedly a small, unimportant, in other terms and in other times, unimportant spot on the map. But here is something that China is proceeding with, and it's proceeding with not just in the Pacific, the South Pacific, but also, as I say, even now in the Atlantic. It's the next target. And that's something that if you don't have a well-functioning network of international of diplomatic connections internationally, then you're liable to miss out on and not read the signs very well. And clearly there was a poor misreading of the situation here, which now has to be remedied quickly, if it can be. But that's, as you say, that's evidence of that contracting of the American worldview, which was, you know, worsened considerably in the 4 years of Trump, with diplomatic appointments being blocked all the time. And we're still really not recovered from that. The State Department is still woefully low-powered as a result of that time.
Well, it's always great to talk with you, David. Once again, David's website is themediabeat.us, and we'll check in with you next week and see what the media brings to us, Dave.
Absolutely. See you then.
All right. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. You can find David's show online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.